Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a federal judge has temporarily blocked President Trump's new asylum ban. We'll discuss the reasoning for the move and how the case may ultimately play out.
First, there are a lot of pieces of history missing from lesson plans and history textbooks. And while the history of the women's movement is taught in classrooms with names like Susan B. Anthony or Harriet Tubman, the author of a new book says there's an important element that's been overlooked.
She says what drove many women to participate in political and social movements is something we don't like to talk about very much and isn't often well received. That's female anger.
Rebecca Traister is a journalist currently writing for New York Magazine and The Cut. Her new book is called Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Rebecca, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So in politics, the media, even in work and home settings, it seems like men can be angry and often get their way or at least make an impact, but an angry woman isn't taken as seriously. What are the ways that male and female anger are described or perceived?
Well, in part because men, and especially white men and powerful white men, are presumed to be rational beings. Their anger can be seen as bolstering their reasoning, a sign of their passion or their strength or their leadership qualities, their willingness to raise their voice and be assertive. But of course, when women get angry, they're often heard as hysterical, as irrational, over-emotional, unattractive. They're told that their anger will get them taken less seriously. Women of color, especially black women, are told that their anger makes them seem threatening. There are all kinds of ways in which if women who are presumed to be irrational and emotional from the start get angry, it only underlines their extra irrationality. And so their anger isn't taken seriously. And part of my argument in Good and Mad is that it certainly should be, especially in political contexts, because their anger has often been politically consequential.
Can you give us an example maybe of how an episode of a man being angry and expressing himself very forcefully, either currently or historically, and then a woman doing basically the same thing, how they're interpreted and portrayed differently?
Sure. We have been taught to fetishize certain instances of men's anger at what they perceive to be inequality. Think about how we think about our founding. The anger of the colonists at being taxed without representation in British government, this is our founding narrative. It's what led to revolution. And the anger, give me liberty or give me death, throwing tea into a harbor, this was political anger at injustice and a lack of representative democracy, and out of that was born a new nation. But of course, that new nation reinscribed the founders who were so mad at not being represented within the government that was policing them and taxing them and governing over them, then created a new country and a government that was built around the enslavement of a population of African Americans and the lack of enfranchisement of women, the unpaid labor of enslaved people and women. And when that oppressed those oppressed people voiced their anger, it wasn't regarded with the same kind of, oh, this is a revolution. In fact, it was regarded as a disruption. And you can look at the history of the suffrage movement, the abolition movement, which took, those movements took decades. The fight for full enfranchisement has taken centuries because the anger of other people, of women, for example, arguing for the vote, those, they were written off as unnatural, as angry Amazons, as hysterical, as bad mothers who were in their pursuit of getting the vote were leaving babies with their incapable dads. So we can see the way that one kind of insurgent political anger at inequality is admired in this country, and that's our patriotism and our looking toward the founding fathers. But other kinds of insurgencies, whether they have taken the form of civil rights movements or the gay rights movement or abolition or suffrage or labor movements, all of which, by the way, have angry women at their start, they're written off as movements that are, especially while they're going on, are disruptive to the power structure, are problematic, are changing the way things are, and they're not usually popular with the public.
And you talk, Rebecca, about the things that are reported in history, the women whose contributions are recognized, that those stories are very much sanitized. And what's missing is the anger in women like Susan B. Anthony, like Rosa Parks. What did their anger look like?
Well, Rosa Parks is a great example because she is an example of a woman who we're taught in our early years was catalytic and formative to the civil rights movement and refusing to give up her seat on a Montgomery bus in Alabama in 1955. But we're taught about her as exhausted and stoic and demure and that she was a seamstress. But in fact, Rosa Parks was a lifelong fighter against racial injustice. She was furious and described herself as angry from the time she was a child at the racism that determined the scope of her opportunities as a black woman in the South, in the United States, in the Jim Crow South. She worked as an investigator for the NAACP, investigating the gang rapes of black women by white men and false claims of sexual assault made by white women against black men. She dedicated her life to political activism, and that activism was stemmed from her anger at inequality and at racist violence. And her decision to sit on that seat and not give it up in 1955 wasn't just because she was exhausted, although I have no doubt that she was, in fact, tired and exhausted. She was angry, and she wanted to engage in civil disobedience in a politicized act. She wanted this to be catalytic to something like the bus boycott, which it wound up being. But we're never told that part of her story. We're never asked to understand Rosa Parks as intentional and political in her actions. It's like the anger is drained from her, and the only way that we can celebrate her is as stoic and tired and nonviolent.
So, Rebecca, do you think that there's been a conscious effort to sanitize, to take that passion out of these acts and remove that element of anger from the telling of these stories?
I do think so, because we're so trained to view women's anger as ugly or unpleasant. We don't want to look straight at it. There's another great example, actually, from the period of the founding. There's one line that we're always taught that was kind of the feminist line during the revolutionary period, and it's from Abigail Adams, who is married to John Adams, who would go on to be president and was one of the founding fathers. And I was always taught that the great line was, "Remember the ladies, John," right? This is what she writes him in a letter in the 1770s. That's the line we learn, "Remember the ladies," which is a pretty mild request, you know, just remember that there are women. The funny thing is, in that same letter, she's far angrier than that line would suggest. In that same letter, she writes that all men would be tyrants if they could. That is a pretty furious statement, suggesting that all men, if given free rein, would be tyrants. That's the language of revolution and tyrannical rule by the king. She then promises in that same letter that if the founders do not include women in their vision for the new nation, she says, "We promise to foment a rebellion." So she is promising revolution along the same lines that her husband is just engaged in. And yet that's stripped from what is passed along to us in the popular narrative, and the way that I was taught this in elementary school, and I think the way that most documentaries, on PBS tell us that all she really asked was, you know, to remember the ladies, when in fact she was promising something far more disruptive politically.
We're talking with Rebecca Traister right now. Her new book is called Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. So that's really interesting what you were just saying, Rebecca, because it seems like if women's anger wasn't seen as a threat, then there wouldn't be a reason to downplay or to dismiss it. So why do you think women's anger is seen as such a threat by men, others in power, and powerful institutions?
Well, I think it is a threat. We know back from that from our founding that anger at inequality, anger at injustice can lead to massive political rupture, can lead to real revolution. That's how this country was born. And I think that given that when it was built around all kinds of inequalities that actually mirrored the very inequalities that the colonists were fighting against when they went to war with England. The lack of representation. You had African Americans and women who were not civically engaged, were not civically permitted to participate, to vote, to be enfranchised. And I think there was always the knowledge that if they revolted in the way that the colonists had revolted against England, that real disruption would be possible. And in fact, we have seen that. That is the story of many of the social movements. That is eventually the abolition movement that led to the emancipation of enslaved people. The 14th and 15th Amendment, the 19th Amendment that enfranchised some women, the Voting Rights Act, which 45 years after that in 1965, fully enfranchised African Americans. There have been versions of revolutions that have expanded opportunities for more people. And again, each and every one of those movements was driven at the beginning in part by women who were furious. The labor movement resulted in higher wages, in workplace safety regulations, limits to some degree on what corporations could ask of their workers, protections for workers. There is revolutionary change possible, but it's going to be anger at inequality that motivates that. And so there's an incentive to keep people who are on the margins, who are in some way subjugated or oppressed, from voicing their anger, because that anger can lead to the kind of connection and coalition building and the organizing that actually does alter and challenge a power structure and how it works.
We're talking with Rebecca Traister. She's a journalist and author, and her newest book is called Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you see a difference in how women's and men's anger are treated? If you're a woman, have there been times in your life where you feel like you made yourself more polite in order to not make a stir? Or do you think you don't have permission to be angry? Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're talking with Rebecca Traister. She's a journalist and author of the new book, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a woman, we'd especially like to hear from you right now. Do you feel comfortable expressing your anger as a woman? And do you think anger helps or hurts political causes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Rebecca, before we took that short break, you were talking about how different marginalized people have been divided and how that has made it easier to prevent coalitions that might form and threaten power structures as they are. And in your book, you also talk about how women have been divided and that different women's anger is treated differently. Talk more about that. How is it different for marginalized women versus, say, straight white women with economic means?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are incredible differences, and one of the hardest parts about progressive organizing, not just within a women's movement in all its iterations, but within all kinds of left movements, is that, of course, many of the power hierarchies, biases, and inequalities are repeated within progressive coalitions. And so, yes, racism in particular and white supremacy is something that has existed within the women's movement, in which so often it's women of color and often black women who have done the groundbreaking thinking, legal work, organizing, sort of pavement pounding, door knocking to be, have done so much of the work of progressive organizing, and very often white women who, because of their proximal power to white men, when they have come into a women's movement, have often sort of become the loudest voices, have become the public faces, have shifted some of the priorities of organizing around the needs of white women. And that's one of the very difficult but necessary conversations that I think is happening now as a women's movement reforms in these years. And there have been extremely angry voices amongst women who are furious about inequality between them. And inequality that is perpetuated even in progressive movements. And that's, I believe that anger, the voicing of it and the listening to it and trying to address what the anger is pointing us toward is one of the crucial steps in moving forward and having stronger and more inclusive progressive movements.
Let's go to the phones, and Marty is on the line in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, everybody. Rebecca, I have your book sitting on the table in the house there, so I'm anxiously awaiting opening it up. I heard about it the evening It must have been a month ago when my book club was getting together, and it's a group of 13 very fabulous women. And boy, talk about a spirited discussion. We had a great time just talking about rage, women's rage. I think women need to get over the reaction to our anger. I'm tired of stepping it back just because I'm afraid, and it's usually of offending a man or making a man. I don't know what I'm going to make a man, but again, this we were talking about your book around the time the Kavanaugh hearings were sort of winding up, or he had just been, I guess, put on the Supreme Court. Can you please talk about any aspect of those hearings that relate to what your book is about? Thank you so very much.
Thanks for that call, Marty. Rebecca?
Thank you, Marty. I appreciate that. And yes, the Kavanaugh, my book was published just 5 days after Christine Blasey Ford gave her testimony and then Brett Kavanaugh gave his. And that was another instance. I almost answered an earlier question about instances where men's anger is heard differently from women's. We could, on that one day, we had two examples of Christine Blasey Ford, who we know instinctively could not have raised her voice in anger as she was telling her story to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Had she raised her voice in anger, despite the fact that she had plenty of things she might well have been justifiably angry about, had she raised her voice, she would have been heard as over-emotional, unreliable as a narrator. She was too emotional to remember the details. It's unthinkable that she could have yelled back or turned the questions back on the questioners the way that Brett Kavanaugh was able to do later in the afternoon. You remember he raised his voice, he wept, he cried, he yelled, he snapped at Senator Amy Klobuchar and said, "Did you black out?" It was an astounding display of anger. And of course, he was backed up by Senator Lindsey Graham, who also had an angry explosion on behalf of Brett Kavanaugh. And I think that the contrast between, it wasn't, on the one hand, it was, yes, Christine Blasey Ford sort of was not permitted to use anger to express herself, and Brett Kavanaugh was. But more than that, had Christine Blasey Ford used anger, it would have undermined her case. It would have confirmed that she was just emotional, that her voice was not a reliable one. But Brett Kavanaugh, who by dint of his gender, his race, and his power within that judiciary chamber, is presumed to be a reasonable thinker. He is offered, there's a presumption that he's rational from the beginning. When he uses anger, he can use it, he's not only allowed to use it, he can wield it as a weapon on his own behalf to underscore how passionately he feels about something, how righteous his fury and his commitments are. And he was able to make his case, at least with the Senate Judiciary, those other powerful people who were fundamentally deciding whether or not to believe him or Dr. Blasey Ford. Brett Kavanaugh was permitted to use anger, and Lindsey Graham was permitted to use anger to strengthen their cases, whereas we know that had Christine Blasey Ford used it, it would have weakened her case. But then the next day, I have to add one more thing. There was another example of women's anger. The two women, Ana Maria Archila and Maria Gallagher, who confronted Jeff Flake in the elevator, and in part because they were not aiming to convince powerful people on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Yes, they were talking to one of them, Jeff Flake. But the reason that their anger, when they confronted him on the elevator and said, "Listen to our stories, you're not believing us, you're not hearing us," and their voices shook and they pointed their fingers, and it was so powerful a clip that it went viral. And I think in part that was because it wasn't to impress the powerful people. It was giving voice to those who felt they didn't have any power, millions of women and men around the country who were so angry and feeling it. And those two women in the elevator gave it voice and channeled that anger of so many people around the country. And that was a very powerful use of anger and women's anger.
We're talking with Rebecca Traister about her new book, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Let's try to take one more call. Kendra in Milwaukee. Hi, Kendra.
Hi there. I am pretty much on the same topic as she was talking about, in that when women are angry, we are thought to be out of control. You know, if our hormones that have taken over, we're not in control, so therefore our arguments can't be considered rational or carry any weight, you know. Just think about being in high school and somebody saying, "What's wrong? Are you on the rag?"
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call, Kendra. And Rebecca, it sounds like that resonates with you.
It does resonate, and I especially like the fact that the first way that Kendra put it was that women are presumed to be out of control. We have to think about that notion of control and how it relates to power and who gets to wield power. And that notion, we could even the way that people reacted after the Kavanaugh hearings when Donald Trump and many of the Republicans tried to cast the female protesters as a mob. Oh, this is a mob that had come after Brett Kavanaugh. There's a way, or after the hashtag MeToo movement of last fall, the way that that was depicted as a witch hunt, something that was out of control, out of order, and chaotic and disruptive. And that's part of the point and the power of women's anger, is that it breaks control, which is, again, its point, because control is how power is wielded, how it is abused, and how people are cut off from it. And so when women are angry, at least from a progressive perspective, what they're doing is challenging and complicating the power of people who traditionally have had a lot of authority to maintain that authority without challenge.
And Rebecca, as we start to wrap up, you know, there were the women's marches, as you said, the Me Too movement, with the midterms, more women than ever being elected to governmental positions. It seems like there are examples of women in a powerful position, you know, speaking truth to power in many of these situations. For women who have been steeped for many, many years in this sense of containing their anger, of being afraid to show their anger, is there a way to build a healthy relationship with justified anger?
I think it begins, the most important part is listening to the anger of those around you. So there are going to be all kinds of different levels of comfort with expressing your anger. And of course, there are real costs to it. This book is not telling women out there to just go rage on, because the truth is that we still get punished and censured if we voice our rage and, you know, get reputations for being difficult or maybe don't get promotions. Women of color are at risk if they get angry. They're at risk of arrest, of injury, of somebody calling the police on them. There are real costs to expressing anger, and I don't want to pretend that those don't exist and just say, go on, everybody, you know, be mad in public. The thing I can encourage is that we start to tune our ears to listen to the anger around us and think about the ways we've been trained to discount it and try to counterbalance that by trying to listen to it, take it seriously. And if we share the anger that we're hearing expressed, communicate with the people who are expressing it and try to find some cooperation and some coalition with them. We have to change how anger is received, and we can do that by changing the ways in which we ourselves listen to it and take it seriously.
Well, Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Traister is a journalist currently writing for New York Magazine and The Cut. She has a new book out. It's called Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger.
I'm J. Carlisle Larson. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm J. Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, soybean farmers in Wisconsin and across the country have been in a bind since the United States and China began a trade war over tariffs. We'll take a look at the impact that's having on U.S. exports, both in the short and long term.
First, President Trump's asylum ban has been put on hold by a federal court. Late last night, a San Francisco judge ruled that the ban violates existing law and would cause irreparable harm to immigrants.
Lawyers from the Justice Department insisted that the president has the power to require asylum seekers to present themselves at official ports of entry. But plaintiffs, including the American Civil Liberties Union and the Southern Poverty Law Center, argued that as long as someone makes it to the U.S., even illegally, they can apply for asylum.
The judge's ruling will stay in effect for a month. It comes as the migrant caravan from Central America continues to approach the U.S.-Mexico border. Elise Cohen is an assistant professor of political science at UW Green Bay's Sheboygan and Manitowoc campuses. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you.
So remind us really quickly what the Trump administration's asylum ban was covering.
Yeah, so on November 9th, the Trump administration used what's called a presidential proclamation, one of the types of executive action that presidents can use. And what he did was try to circumvent some of the laws allowing anyone on U.S. territory, even if they crossed irregularly or illegally, to claim asylum. So basically this order or proclamation, I should say, spelled out that the president has the authority if someone is detrimental to the interests of the United States under federal law to use that power to prevent their entry. So this would really be a dramatic change in asylum laws if this had gone through.
Now, why does the Justice Department, it's been arguing that the president has the authority to enforce this. Why are they taking this stance?
Well, the stand of the Justice Department and the Trump administration and Department of Homeland Security focuses on the national security threat posed by illegal immigrants entering along the southern border, particularly in light of the so-called migrant caravan that has been comprised of Central Americans making their way up through Mexico towards the southern border of the U.S. This national security kind of threat language has been used by the administration and by those agencies. They've also used the language of the system being broken and overwhelmed, that the asylum system just cannot handle the sheer number of people that apply for asylum every year. So we see kind of a mixture of reasons, both focusing on the threat these people may pose, as well as the system itself being overburdened.
Now, there's a lot of confusion over how people can apply or seek asylum when they do come into U.S. ports of entry. Can you clarify what some of, some of the confusion is when it comes to how people seek asylum?
Yeah, that's a great question. You're absolutely right. I think people confuse asylum with immigration in general. So to qualify for asylum, the person must prove a well-founded fear of persecution. This can be based on race, religion, nationality, political beliefs, or their membership in some kind of social group. In order to request asylum, the way we do it in the United States is you must be present in the U.S. or at an official entry point, somehow on U.S. territory. Refugees are a little different. We only take refugees that have been vetted already by the United Nations and are coming from overseas. So refugees go through a different process. But for those asylees or potential asylees, asylum seekers, we would call them, they would already be on the territory or at one of those border checkpoints, and they would then go to an officer for screening, what is called a credible fear interview, to see if they can pass that initial interview threshold of meeting those qualifications.
We are talking to Elise Cohen right now. She's an assistant professor of political science at UW Green Bay's Sheboygan and Manitowoc campuses, and she's with us to talk about a recent asylum ban put in place by the Trump administration that was basically put on hold by a San Francisco-based judge. And let's take a look at that judge. I guess the first question is it a surprise that the federal judge based in San Francisco blocked the ban?
It's not too much of a surprise. The judge was appointed by Obama during the Obama administration. And we know that the travel ban, which of course was very controversial from last year's executive action under President Trump, also initially had injunctions at this sort of lower federal court level, district level. So if we would see a similar path, we might expect the Trump administration to appeal this decision just as it did with those previous injunctions of its travel ban or the different versions of them. The Supreme Court upheld the travel ban this summer, right? So there is some speculation that if they would appeal this and it would make its way all the way up to the Supreme Court in the future, what kind of ruling might we see moving forward on this case?
Now, you mentioned that, with the travel ban, that it was pretty controversial. Lower federal courts challenged it. They put a stay on it. It eventually was not approved, but it was upheld by the Supreme Court. What tactics do you think the Trump administration and the Justice Department will take, as this continues? Because this is only on hold for about a month.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's only until December 19th, I believe, that we have this temporary injunction. One thing that the Trump administration has continued to emphasize and even cites directly in the presidential proclamation issued earlier this month is that the Immigration and Nationality Act, that major set of federal laws that govern our immigration system right now, specifies that the president does have the authority to prevent the entry of any alien if it is, quote, detrimental to the interests of the United States. And that's kind of vague, right? That's sort of ambiguous, not exactly clear, who gets to decide and what those criteria are. In the travel ban case, the very close decision, the 5-4 decision, the justices in the majority ended up thinking that
the president really didn't have to prove detailed, reasoned bases for the danger or being detrimental to those interests. So I think the Trump administration would see, well, we have the potential once again to use that broad executive power given to us in the Immigration and Nationality Act to claim that these Central American migrants crossing through the southern border are detrimental to the interests of the United States.
Well, getting back to that that so-called migrant caravan, it was dominating the news pretty much up until the midterm election. Homeland Security officials say some 6,000 people are waiting to be processed at ports of entry along the border from San Diego, with more on the way. You know, what exactly, so much as you can, is happening at the southern border?
Yes, I've heard the same thing that you're reporting, that there are thousands of these Central American migrants kind of waiting in a crowded sports complex and some sort of squalid shelters in parts of Mexico that are near the border entry points. One thing to think about in terms of the executive proclamation, he's saying that you cannot get asylum if you go irregularly, meaning you go between ports of entry. But for some people, because of the long wait time at the official ports of entry, there's speculation that that's actually what's sort of driving them to go cross illegally or irregularly. There's also a lack of understanding that some of these migrants may have, where they believe you can only claim asylum if you're physically on the territory of the U.S. So they may believe that you have to cross in whatever means possible in order to even make the asylum claim, which is not true, but that could be part of the story. And then finally, we've heard some reports from human rights groups that even at the official ports of entry, the Border Patrol is kind of turning people away or just delaying their entry to somehow, again, deter them from entering and claiming asylum.
Now, immigration, refugees, all this has been part of the political conversation as of late. It has been pretty central to some of the some of the executive orders that the president has put out. Why do you think that this has suddenly, or not even suddenly, but why do you think this has become such a central figure in our sort of political discourse right now?
Oh, that's a really great point. In studying the politics of immigration and refugees, we can see this has become so politicized, and you're absolutely right. It's kind of like peak politicization, especially on things like refugees and asylum, which there used to be pretty broad bipartisan support for refugees and asylum seekers. But in this context, we see it with the politicization of the zero-tolerance immigration stance of the Department of Justice and the Trump administration. That resulted earlier this year in the separation of families. We've seen efforts to bypass detention restrictions. How long can you detain asylum seekers and families and children? Even quotas, trying to force immigration judges to hear those asylum cases much more quickly. So I think we can put this in the bigger picture of asylum and refugees and these humanitarian categories of immigration protection being lumped in with the broader picture of the immigration debate in this country, where political polarization, unfortunately, has spilled over and made some of those humanitarian forms of protection politicized that once were bipartisan in terms of their support.
You just mentioned that this has had sort of broad bipartisan support in the past. Can we get back to that?
Yeah, that's a really challenging question. I think that when we've seen the last attempts of Congress to pass immigration reform, something that, would actually fulfill the Constitution's vision that Congress would make these kinds of immigration laws rather than presidents issuing all these proclamations and executive orders, we've seen that both times in sort of the mid-2000s and then again in 2014, because our political polarization has affected our members of Congress, we haven't been able to reach the consensus needed for any of those immigration reform bills to make it out. Even this summer, when they were trying on another one, we saw that the Republicans were divided into two camps, the so-called hardliners that did not want to see any path for legal status for people that were undocumented, and the more moderate Republicans that were willing to give a lot on border patrol and increased security and fencing, but did want to see a path for legal status, as most Americans do in public opinion polls. So it seems like even the Republican Party just has such sharp divisions right now
between the so-called hardliners and moderates over immigration that it's unlikely we would get that law coming through anytime soon.
We have just about 30 seconds left, Elise. So final question, what are you going to be watching for as with the situation, especially with the caravan and the asylum ban? What are you watching for as this plays out?
What I'm really interested in is if the Trump administration will take this all the way up and continue to appeal it and fight this case moving forward. There is a provision of the Immigration and Nationality Act that says there are exceptions to any alien being able to apply for asylum, even if they didn't go through the port of arrival, on, quote, reasonable grounds for regarding them as a danger to the security of the U.S. So I'm really going to be watching to see how the courts respond to that argument and if the Trump administration is able to use that to justify its action.
Elise, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
Elise Cohen is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Green Bay's Sheboygan and Manitowoc campuses. We talked with her about the future of President Trump's asylum ban after a federal judge put it on hold last night.
Coming up, the trade war between the United States and China shows no signs of abating, and that's putting soybean farmers across the country and here in Wisconsin in a tough place.
Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, Amazon recently chose the location for its second headquarters after a year-long bidding war between hundreds of cities. We'll look at how the process played out and whether public incentive offers have gotten out of hand.
Now, in 2017, Wisconsin produced nearly 101 million bushels of soybeans. This accounted for more than 2% of the soy grown in the entire United States, and much of Wisconsin's soybean exports went to China.
While China has long been one of the main buyers of American soy, that relationship is in jeopardy following ongoing retaliatory tariffs put in place by China after the Trump administration implemented tariffs of its own on Chinese goods.
The trade war has put American farmers in a tough spot, many of whom are sitting on a substantial harvest of soy. Our next guest is here to talk about how farmers are weathering the tariffs and what the long-term impact could be on the American soy market. Isis Almeida is the senior agriculture commodities reporter for Bloomberg. Isis, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Isis, set the scene a little bit for us. U.S. soy farmers have basically had one harvest under these tariffs. So what does the soy market look like currently?
Well, the soy market continues to look pretty depressed. I mean, with tariffs to the biggest customer, China, there's really no soybeans flowing from the U.S. to China at this point, and farmers don't really have an outlet to sell. One of the things they can do is they can try to gain new markets, but gaining new markets takes time. So at the moment, they really have to stash their soy wherever they can.
And so what are some of these new markets that they might be looking into?
I think one of the new markets that the U.S. has already looked into is Taiwan, and I think there has already been some memorandum of understandings and some deals done with Taiwan, and you see, but nothing is as big as China, you know. There's deals done to Sri Lanka, there are some more U.S. soybeans going to Europe, but it's quite hard to replace such a big customer as China. If you think about, China imports almost 100 million tons of soybeans every year, and the next biggest customer is Europe with about 16 million tons. So it's very, very hard to replace China.
Now, you mentioned just a moment ago that many of these soy farmers in particular are just sitting on their stash. What are some of the long-term issues for farmers when they have to do that?
Well, we've seen previously in history, and I think this is one of the points that sometimes people forget to look at, we had an export ban on soybeans in 1973 under the government of Richard Nixon. And at the time, Japan was the biggest buyer of U.S. soy. And even though that embargo only lasted about 2 weeks, that created a huge shift in the market because Japan realized, should I trust the U.S. all the time? Should I be so reliant on one country? And the answer to them was no. So they actually started investing in Brazil, and, you know, they were part of the big wave of investment that started a soybean industry in Brazil. So these embargoes, even though they're short, they can have very long-lasting impacts. You saw the same thing with the 1980 Soviet embargo, and that at the time those were grains, and it was under Jimmy Carter as well, and the U.S. wasn't sending any grain to the Soviet Union, and that also kind of tarnished the U.S.'s reputation as a reliable supplier. You know, food is very, very important for so many countries, and keeping their populations fed is really, really crucial to political stability. So once that you start having those embargoes, you countries start to think, do I want to be so reliant on one country, and what can I do to diversify my supplies? And I think what's happening here with the soybean embargo is that many countries, you know, and you look at China is already thinking, you know, how can I diversify my supply? So China is buying more from Brazil, is buying more from Argentina. China is also reducing the amount of soybeans that go into their animal feed rations. So, you know, will they, if the trade war ended today, would things go back to being exactly like they were before? And the answer to that is probably not.
We're talking to Isis Almeida. She is the senior agriculture commodities reporter for Bloomberg. And we are talking about issues facing soybean farmers here in Wisconsin, but also nationwide as these ongoing tariffs between the United States and China ramp up. Now, Isis, farmers are clearly in the middle of this dispute. It's not as though they are a government entity. These are people who are, you know, sowing the seeds, harvesting, taking care of these crops throughout, you know, a harvest. They're being challenged by other issues just outside of this trade war. There are companies that they have to work with that are responding in kind and have sort of a bigger base that they can, you know, maneuver out of this. What are these other issues that farmers are dealing with on this front?
I think many of the issues that farmers will have to deal with, I think the first one is, how do they store? Because if they don't have anywhere to sell, soybean is a valuable crop. If you think about, you know, most farmers grow corn and soybeans, and soybeans are 2 to 3 times the price of corn. So farmers want to figure out a way to store those valuable items much more. So one of the things that you start to see is ground piles. So they pile up, you know, their corn outside on the ground. And you would have think, oh, why are they not piling soybeans? Because they are trying to make space inside a silo for soybeans, because soybeans tend to rot faster because they also are more expensive crops. So for a farmer, if he loses 100,000 tons of corn or 1,000 tons, because nobody is actually producing 100,000 tons mostly, but if a farmer loses 1,000 tons of corn, it's less of a financial burden for him than losing 1,000 tons of soybeans. So you start to see that. You also start to see them putting in bags, which is something that started in Argentina. So the Argentine farmers started putting soybeans in plastic bags, and they look like these really long sausages, the size of like sometimes a football field. And they started to do that. So they're looking at it like, well, what can I do with my soybeans? And they starting to put into bags. The other challenge that farmers are facing, and in some parts of the country, especially in the lower Mississippi Delta, is that it's rained a lot as well. So not only do they have to deal with tariffs, but the rain has damaged a lot of their soybeans. And some of the companies out there are struggling to keep soybeans. So if you think of the grain elevators of some of the big companies out there, normally they are bringing soybeans in. Yes, there is some damage. They can mix the damaged ones with the good ones and get to export specs, put it on a barge, and send it down to the Gulf. And they do that every year. But in the year where their grain isn't moving or the soybeans aren't moving, it's hard. It gets hard as the silos fill up. It gets harder and harder to mix damaged soybeans. So many of the companies out there have increased the discount. So when farmers come, hey, here's my soybean, they then, you know, they look at the percentage of damage, and the higher the damage, the higher the discount. And to send farmers a sign, look, we really can't take your soybeans, many companies have actually increased that discount. Is it to say that, oh my God, the companies are being difficult with the farmers? No, not, it's not necessarily the case. Everybody is trying to deal with this operation the best way they can. But the bottom line is, in the end, that the farmer is really suffering.
Is there any recourse for these farmers in the end?
Well, they could count on, I think this is a tough question. I think the Trump administration has approved some help for the farmers, and that kind of subsidy will help them get through. They got to start thinking very soon that if these tariffs don't end, what are they going to plant next year? So are they going to keep planting soybeans, or are they going to turn to corn and wheat? And I think price. I think the situation with price will be very determined. If we're still in the same situation with China, farmers will look, what's the price of wheat, what's the price of corn, what will bring me more return, and will then shift to one of these crops. But I guess it's a lot of it is wait and see, because most of the plantings will happen in spring next year.
Well, Isis, we'll have to leave it there for right now, but thank you so much for joining us on Central Time today.
Thank you.
Isis Almeida is the senior agriculture commodities reporter for Bloomberg. She was with us to talk about how the U.S.-China trade war is impacting soybean farmers here in Wisconsin and across the country, and how it could impact the American soybean market for years to come. A lot of us around here are fans of chocolate. So a story out of Asheville, North Carolina really caught our attention today.
16-year-old Lily Thurmond posted a video showing a family of bears getting into her car and into its contents.
There's three bears in my car at the moment. Three. Oh, there comes another one. Oh, he's got more stuff.
So the stuff she's referring to is chocolate bars, 50 of them to be exact. That's what she was supposed to sell for a high school fundraiser.
In another part of the video, she says it's proof that the chocolate was actually eaten by the bears, not, you know, by Lily or her family. Not that that's ever happened when people have to sell candy or cookies or popcorn or...
Yeah, I feel like I remember being like, all right, when I had to sell the same sort of thing, being like, all right, I'm just going to eat them and my parents, I guess, will pay for it.
Exactly. I remember doing little hashtags on the envelope for how many bars of chocolate I had actually eaten. Well, the funny thing, one of the funny things about this is that the bears ate dark chocolate, milk chocolate, and those chocolate almond bars, but they left one.
They left one. I mean, I feel like 2018 has been the year where I've identified a lot with wild bears, and this is like maybe the latest story where I've been like, yeah, I know where you're coming from, bear.
Well, and it's like the Midwestern thing where you can't take the last donut. You take half of the last donut.
You have to leave the one so you're not the one that did it. So
this is Central Time.